It seems it's now 2 o'clock, and let's just get started. This morning, we heard how Stirling influenced generations of students of architecture. Students of architecture in North America, through his own teaching, but also in Europe, often more at a distance, at arm's length. I think there were years and years where the black book, and later the white book, or the other way around, became the sort of essential ingredient for students of architecture's little libraries. The first architectural monograph that you spent your difficultly earned money on in order to establish your own library. Where I studied at Delft, his influence was felt quite strongly in the early 1980s. In that period, there was even a Samisdat monograph in Dutch of the work of James Stirling, sort of coinciding with the other publications, which students had put together and which was spread at a very, very low cost across the student body. These publications, like any architecture school, I think Delft produced them in that period. In Delft, they were really acts of resistance against the oppressive dominance of the coterie of Aldo van Eyck and Herman Hertzberger. Students loving architecture, producing their own books, and looking towards Stirling. It was also a reaction or an act of resistance against those who, from the sort of period of democratization, had concluded that architecture didn't matter altogether. That is what Stirling was. Now, when I arrived at the school, and I'm just taking the school not for my own personal reasons, but because it's a typical, say, European architecture school, that interest had mostly, at least, been eclipsed by the appearance of Ermé. The Kunsthal was being built in Rotterdam. Later, Rem Koolhaas introduced the schemes for the ZKM Media Center at Karlsruhe and the Jussieu Library and the terminal at Zeebrugge. Against that onslaught of an architecture beyond architecture, as we saw it then, Stirling appeared sort of anachronistic, almost staid, as if not quite so relevant. Personally, I do remember going to Stuttgart and admiring the urban decisions in the Staatsgalerie, the way that you actually go through the building, that beautiful central space, but also being puzzled by the details and particularly the colors. I was really wondering whether there could be some kind of pleasure in ugliness. And in what was then still fairly gloomy West Berlin, the pastel colors of the Wissenschaftszentrum, what were they? An affront to modernism, which was still taught in most Dutch or German architecture schools? Interesting, perhaps, but really anything beyond naughty? And then there was, of course, something like the Swan Song, the bookshop at the Biennale, elegant, restrained, beautifully green under the trees of the Giardini. But by that time, Stirling had almost gone. It was history. 20 years after his untimely death, James Stirling's work, you could argue, has become something of a historic legacy. It has certainly become material for architectural historians. We've witnessed that in the morning. The recent renewed attention to the projects from the architect's early collaboration with James Gahn, so the red brick buildings in Leicester, Cambridge, and Oxford, could be said to be informed by a desire to recuperate Stirling, for the history of post-war modern architecture. We also know that a lot of the writing is actually to do with the question as to whether he was modern or postmodern or neither. By contrast, the work of the later Sterling, the work of the 70s and 80s, those exercises in some pink and baby blue, and the deployment on of classical cornices or rustica, the fragments of Schinkel, Ledoux, or Hawksmoor, and at the same time Le Corbusier, all those things cannot so easily be appropriated as revisions of modern architecture. They also cannot be appropriated as revisions of the larger ideological projects of and projections of modern architecture. They are somehow completely outside that type of argument. On the other hand, the use of historic references, which so irritated critics defending the legacy of the modern movement in the 1980s, has also lost its explosive character, as postmodernism itself has just become a faint memory, or, depending on one's point of view, an aberration. In any case, the rhetorically charged borrowings from the pre-war avant-garde and post-war Mies, as proposed by Omé, or the variations on a theme of the new simplicity in the Swiss manner, have replaced the preoccupations of architecture of Sterling's generations with European urban forms. Many of the urban renewal operations in London and other British cities, meanwhile, are marked by the reappearance of an acontextual planning of the crudest sort, dressed now in staid, fatigued variations of high-tech, or worse, just reflecting the effect of unprecedented overdevelopment. I'm just memorizing the cramped open spaces in projects such as St. Giles in the West End, or those piazzas formed by the buildings on of the GLA, or the nondescript squares surrounding the new buildings in Spitalfields, near Spitalfields Market. To me, they all demonstrate a notable absence of ideas how buildings might relate to their surroundings in other ways than just merely occupying their sites. It is, I guess, against this background that the exercises in urban form in the work of James Sterling acquire a new significance, a new significance as urban compositions. The treatment of figures and ground and of memorable images and objects in the Neue Staatsgalerie in Stuttgart or the Wissenschaftszentrum constitute a poignant and physically present critique of contemporary urban development. I would argue that this, beyond the reassessment of modernism, postmodernism, and Sterling's role in it, represents the most important legacy of Sterling's approach to cities and buildings for the current for current architectural practice. How did I get involved in here? Penelope has already pointed to the publication Oase, and actually I was going to hold it up, but then forgot. Sterling. The Sterling issue by the Dutch magazine Oase, also a student publication initially, some 20 years ago. Anyway, about 3 years ago, Oase got approached by a group of Belgian architects and one Italian. They asked us whether we wanted to make a monograph on Sterling. There had been a precedent, a similar issue of On the Smithsons by Max Rysselaar and Dirk van den Heuvel. Many of you will know that volume, which of course was much more in line with preoccupations at Delft, also because the Smithsons had actually told there. So it was Joachim de Klerk, Kerstin Geers, and Pier Paolo Tamburelli who prompted us to consider the idea of a reappraisal, and I must say I was very intrigued by that. We agreed quite quickly that we weren't actually interested in an exercise in architectural historiography, none of us being trained as an architectural historian, but really as an attempt to uncover what Stirling's work offered as lessons for architecture in the present circumstances. I guess we were perhaps also more intrigued by this work than necessarily immediately attracted by it. But then, as far as I'm concerned, in the process of doing this work, working on an issue like this, this is a magazine which has a sort of preparation time of almost 2 years. So you can imagine, you know, you go through some kind of intellectual process. Anyway, in that process, for me at least, the appreciation grew. Appreciation of an approach to architecture as a personal, yet also always rational, at the same time idiosyncratic and universal or universalist, as an outcome of working from an accumulation of knowledge, deep knowledge, without ever being academic. It was also in this process that one could start to appreciate the work of the James Stirling of the 1970s and the 1980s, rather than the architect of Leicester, which, with its references to industrial architecture and Russian constructivism or the avant-garde, had always seemed more palatable. And one could also see that much of what seemed overdetermined, frivolous, epic at first sight was indeed a very serious engagement with context. Stirling's work is not contextual in any literal manner, as I think Kirsten Fierce and Patrick Lynch showed in their articles in Oase and will probably show today. Rather, it seems to involve identifying narrative forms that activate something new or hidden in the context, and that somehow, occasionally, also activate something about the atmosphere context. I think I would argue that is the case in, for example, this building, Number One Poultry, which, of course, one is also looking at in a new way, given all these sort of steel and glass carbuncles appearing on either side of it. And one could also see that what appeared as stark and overpowering image-making was actually rather precise and sometimes even modest. Connections realized by rather careful and inventive site planning, using the whole modernist, if you like, apparatus of planning. Circulation arrangements that, as René Scalbert will show in his reading of the building we are in, benefited from the architect's analytical approach in order to become, you could say, ceremonial passages. And a work which of course always benefited from looking at both John Soane and Le Corbusier, never just only one. It is Stirling's contribution to thinking about cities that I would propose is of particular interest. There were two things that struck me when leafing through Anthony Vidler's beautiful catalogue. One, how deeply the work of this architect, who saw himself as, I think, as an individual artist, and was seen by others often as a maverick, is affected by the atmosphere, even the ethos, of post-war Europe. How, in other words, ideas about the common good are informing the design of buildings and of cities as collective works of art. And that becomes also extremely clear in that very surprising project for the housing in Lima, which I had really forgotten about and was reminded, in fact, by your book and those very, very beautiful images. Two, for me even perhaps more interesting, and it sort of makes a connection to something we discussed this morning, there's rarely a hint of an infatuation with cars or car traffic in any of the work. Indeed, there's absolutely no image that would suggest any particular interest in cars. I may be wrong, but I just looked through the catalogue. I didn't see any of that. And of course, that is really, really surprising, because it, against the background of other especially British architects in that period. So Stirling, rather surprisingly, comes across as an architect for the pedestrian. For the pedestrian who can walk across landscapes dotted with significant buildings, sometimes more so than others. Okay. This afternoon has one aspect, which is the question, what can these buildings actually mean now for current practices, for current thinking on architecture? It means that, of course, the afternoon is far looser than the morning. We have a series of lectures, two by architects, one by one of these people who start off as architect and then venture out in all sorts of other trades, architect, writer, historian. After that, we'll see what kind, if any, conclusions we can draw from this. Let me start asking Kirsten Fiers to come to the fore. Kirsten, like the other two, in fact, was a partner in crime, but Kirsten was a partner in crime from the first minute in the OASA event. Kirsten is an architect and principal of office Kirsten Fiers David van Sèvres, in the heart of Brussels, in Belgium. He's a guest professor at Ghent University in Belgium and teaches at the Academy of Architecture in Mendrisio in Switzerland, and at this moment responsible for quite a large number of buildings.
Thank you, Christoph. Well, not so large amount, these buildings, but whatever, we try. Christoph already introduced it extensively. But not only me, it seems, played this afternoon the role of the dump architect. So I'll show a lot of images, and there's a lot of associative thinking, I suspect. But then again, I guess, that's what we like to do. When we made the issue for OASE, we called, after some discussion, we called the OASE the James Stirling's architecture, a non-dogmatic accumulation of formal knowledge. That was kind of a long subtitle, but a very important one to us, in the extent that we believe that, as Christoph had beautifully explained, if you would look at Stirling, let's say afresh, without any formal knowledge of historical background, you would be able to look at that whole body of work as an accumulation, a non-dogmatic accumulation, because here and there's some very particular twists of formal knowledge. In other words, as an extremely rich vault of possible architectures. That is maybe easiest to understand when you argue, and that's also how we made the introduction at the time, and when you make a very simple statement, James Stirling architecture started in 1964. There was no James Stirling before. In 1964, in the quarrel with James Gowan on the Cambridge Library, and the fact that it was a bad copy of what they had been collaborating on before, you could argue that exactly with the recognition of the fact that there were elements to keep and to endlessly reproduce, and while reproducing them, to rethink them, reproduce them again, and hence slowly developing piece by piece some kind of vocabulary, Stirling, dubbed classicist by Gowan, started on his real course. So, what would that real course have been about? Let me start very strangely, maybe. Maybe that was his course. In the sense that when you leaf through Robert Venturi's 1966 Complexity and Contradiction in Architecture, and you read it and you read it again, and I'm sure everybody of you have done it like probably 100 times, you start to understand that, of course, and that's not new, the whole book is not so much a sequence of 10 different chapters with different ideas, but it's a very simple, straightforward manifesto towards a difficult whole. Or in other words, as Venturi has formulated it as the title of chapter number 10, the last chapter of his book, The Obligation Towards the Difficult Whole. So chapter number 1 till 9 being a manifesto for non-straight architecture, or his argument for ambiguity, the limitations of order, the argument of the inside or the outside, and a couple more, of course. In the end, were, you could argue, preparations for a kind of architecture which you could only be defined as an architecture of the difficult whole. Neither of the other 9 examples are entirely explained by either of the titles he used in the book, nor rather the notion of difficult whole, the complex concept of something which as a whole seems to function, even though it is difficult, as he argues himself, it's not a set of different elements as a group, it's not one or two objects you can recognize as objects, but it's a composition of elements, which in itself, through the concept of infliction, and that's a very important topic in his argument, infliction, the idea of referring to that what is contained in the middle without really showing it. Infliction, which you see in this page, you see actually a Morris Lewis painting below, you see the Ellsworth Kelly painting, always of course reproduced in black and white, so stronger in the notion of two more or less equal bodies referring to that what is in the middle. And you see obviously the Piero La Francesca painting, the Flagellation of Christ, where even though the composition of the different figures is complex and not at all in either side the same, there's an implicit idea of something else, that what is contained, which is contained in the complexity of the composition, which is what Venturi would argue for is the infliction of the project. Probably the closest by to where we are today, and maybe one of the simplest, clearest examples of what he is referring to, was Rand's Greenwich Hospital, here on the right, a picture from Complexity and Contradiction, where indeed the set of buildings and the composition, the asymmetrical position of the tower as such, seems to be able, at least according to Venturi, to make a composition which makes, on the one hand, the whole complex as a whole, makes it open and permeable, and at the same time allows this complexity to make it into a proper complex mise-en-scène. This is, of course, I was happy to see the pyramid here in the gallery of David Hockney. This is his 1971-72 painting, Portrait of an Artist, in which he paints Peter Sesslinger, at that time just not anymore his boyfriend, and in which he, subtitle, Pool with Two Figures. Portrait of an Artist could be interpreted on the one hand, of course, as the portrait of the photographer Peter Sesslinger, but at the same time, of course, you could understand it as an idea of a self-portrait. The movie, or the film which has been made around that same period about David Hockney, somehow indicates to that, and indicates to this very complex way that painting got to be finally painted, constructed, and how, in so many ways, the combination of this very differently painted left bottom side, the picture of a guy in the pool, and the figure in the jacket with the jacket, Peter, on the right, standing on the pool, combined with the background of the different mountains, south of France, a picture of a pool. And as I guess all of you know, Hockney often paints these pictures, and especially this one, by combining a different set of pictures taken on different moments and finally composing the idea of the painting to ultimately reproduce it. Now, this idea of a portrait of an artist, in other words, of the idea of a self-portrait to a certain extent, but in which you yourself are absent, is, understanding this being 1972, intriguing. In 1974, James Stirling makes, as we know, the RIBA drawings exhibition, and for that occasion is made this red book on the left side. So James Stirling, RIBA drawings collection. 2 years later, in 1976-77, he makes part two, the second edition. I guess, I don't know, it was probably sold out. And of course, in 3 years, a lot had happened. In 1974, when he makes the small book, this book, the black book, as has been referred to before, wasn't yet finished. And even though he was busy with it for many years already, among other people, with Leon Krier, trying to redraw and draw drawings, take pictures, and so forth, for that particular catalogue, the catalogue came too late. So there was a need for another book, a smaller book, you could say, an intermediate product, perhaps, to accompany the exhibition. But if you look at that little book today, I would argue if there was one moment in which Stirling managed to make some kind of self-portrait, it was probably there. And without going deep into each of these projects, we all know, the Leicester, McGowan still, Cambridge, not anymore, Cambridge again, Roman Long, Oxford, Oxford again, and you see a switch. You see the switch from the axonometry of to the perspective. I remember while writing together on the Oase issue and arguing how important Krier was to the axonometries, he replied us via a contact person that he had no responsibility whatsoever, but the perspectives certainly were his. Well, for whatever it's worth, what's interesting about it is, of course, that this set of drawings completely disconnected from reality, much more disconnected from reality than the oeuvre catalogue, the black book, which obviously had its echo, or tried to be an echo of the oeuvre complète of Le Corbusier, while taking away, cutting away the pictures of the projects in reality, tried to create, I would say, an architecture of drawing, an architecture which ultimately showed, slowly, project after project, a set of possible moves, a would-be vocabulary. At the same time, the drawing technique changes a little bit. Still, even though the drawings are done by different people, the introduction by Rainer Banham to the book, very beautiful introduction, is in that sense, I think, very telling, in which he says, you know, they reveal the man, they reveal their impersonal coverings that can both say something for Stirling without saying something about him. Or, another one, Zipatone and patent glazing reveal the man by denying him. This idea of making a portrait of an absent man, but at the same time being, for that reason, extremely accurate, is, I think, what's at stake here. Interestingly, let's say, after this section of different Axos perspective of what has to be known later as the group of university buildings, you see here the Olivetti, and you see this is the Olivetti in Milton Keynes, which was never executed. You see that gradually, more than drawings of complete buildings, you start to see drawings of ingredients of buildings, apparently drawn by Krier. You see here objects, parts of the Milton Keynes Olivetti factory, as it was never built. And you see ultimately a project where Krier still today claims the most authorship to, the Derby Town Center, where the proper perspective shows for the first time a real urban setting. Maybe I would say let's keep in mind the ingredients and the setting. If in 1976 Stirling decides to enlarge the Red Book and makes the Green Book, he adds the following pages. And I decided to leaf through them with you quickly, through all of them, so you get to see them. And you see that he starts, funnily enough, with a drawing, hand drawing, a collection of his sketches. I'm sure I have to apologize, I couldn't be here in the early morning, so I didn't see what has been shown. I'm sure some of these drawings have been shown before, but these are not found drawings, these are the drawings he has published himself at that time in a book, little doodles, which in some way seem to stress, even, in that sense, even contrary to what Benham says, rather personal idea of authorship, but which work here very much, not so much as proper elements of content, but rather as rhythmic in between pages in an overall micro over catalog. Because this page, I think 96, echoes an earlier page, which is a page, if I'm not mistaken, 46 or something like that, in the earlier book. So this first new page mirrors the middle of his first part of the Red Book. After the first new page come, I would say, 2.5 projects. First of all, St. Andrews, never built, but you see all of a sudden that many of the ingredients, as have been shown in the end of the Red Book, start to play a far more specific role. But more importantly, that was the half project, he shows the two German projects in 1976. He has just done these two competitions, two German projects it's called. He lost them both. And of course, we all know the third one, he ends up winning. But these two competitions are very interesting. Of course, we're talking here of the Dusseldorf and the Köln competition. Here you see the Dusseldorf one, the North Rhine-Westphalia of 75. Afterwards, you will see the Köln one. What happens there is that the same drawing technique all of a sudden seems to single out objects, very much in the fashion, in the idea of the last drawing I showed you of the Red Book. And these singled out objects seem to show trajectories, seem to show loose composition of elements, which ultimately seem to be able to compose an urban idea. Who knows? Which ends up, of course, here in the North Rhine-Westphalia. Again, the break, and here in Köln, Wallraf Richards. So similarly here again, you see that the elements has been introduced, elements which are already, I think, very far away from the early axonometries, from the early perspectives, become clearly urban strategies. But why? Because they become complex compositions of different things. Not anymore objects, maybe complex objects as they were, but tableaus, you could say. And always these ingredients. Okay. So back to Venturi for a second. I will not take too long of your time. Venturi, of course, in his 1966 and his reproduction of 1977 of Complexity and Contradiction, he includes some projects. He includes projects after, of course, the historical reading, very ideological reading, one could say anti-modernist reading, who knows, of architecture and what to be done against it. He adds a set of projects, some executed, some not, which need to prove that he's on the right track, obviously himself. I think probably one of the most notable examples of that is the nursery house you see here on the right side. And here, zoom in, where you see that indeed, on the scale of a building, Venturi seems to manage beautifully in combining all different kind of ingredients, whether it's the entrance porch, the big opening, if you see it on the plan, the cutout for the car park, each of these elements, the balcony, into a complex whole as a composition of a building. But it remains a building. Same thing here, the Morris House, if I'm not mistaken, not built. Similar kind of approach. In a way, if you look at that with a certain distance, I would say very close to certain Stirling compositions. And then, of course, I decided to put in the most obvious, maybe, of all examples he puts in his Complexity and Contradiction. You see the Guildhaus. The Guildhaus, which is essentially a three-dimensional composition of volumes, which is in itself very complex, which maybe has been communicated over time as is building with the big name, Guildhaus, but which, when you look at it, when you visit it, is a difficult whole in very much of its elements in what they combine into one complex of Eldry Holm. But then, of course, something really terrible happens. Who knows? He goes to Las Vegas. Learning from Las Vegas. In some bizarre way, and there's probably a history to be written there, because Denise Scott Brown, as we know, was here in London, kind of visiting meetings of the Independent Group. Independent Group looking here from London to the States. American woman looking to people looking to the States in London. Very complex. Very confusing idea of pop. And, you know, you have the whole argument, the whole discourse, you think, decorated shed, duck. Learning from Las Vegas had a tremendous impact on the production of Venturi, I would argue. Good, we're not here talking about Venturi. Nevertheless, here, not a beautiful building, of course, but a very different one. The three-dimensionality of the difficult whole and its composition becomes simply 2D, a box with a bizarre facade, a decorated shed. But even that square, a square, a flat square, an idea, a joke, who knows? Or, and I'm not judging the quality of the buildings, because often they're very interesting, but they're far away from the idea, the notion of difficult whole. So what happened with the difficult whole? We know what happened with Venturi. Here it is. The difficult whole is probably a concept which is only truly executed on an urban scale by Stirling. This building, the Staatsgalerie, Stuttgart, is the perfect example of it, I would argue. And of course, these little books, as I showed you before, they were, you could argue, in retrospect, who knows? It's interpretation, the preparation for it. And if you look at that model, it was the competition model from 1977, one of the competition models. And you see that model in its, I would say, purity. You don't see the stripes, you see nothing. You see purely the composition. I think you already understand. What's interesting about it is that it's an urban concept, which is in its idea of containing something in its middle, which is clearly urban and open, and still very composed. It's very different from Rossi's, and I kind of deliberately took here a very old, Via Farini project of Rossi, Rossi's notion of architectura la città, in the sense that Rossi's notion is one of fragments which maybe signify many things in themselves, but never relate one to another in order to contain something. No infliction. Here again we see, in fact, the Roma Interrotta scheme of Rossi. Same thing. If there is a narrative, it's in the objects themselves. It's the metaphor, who knows? It's the memory. Even there is an issue here, a notion of Kohlhaasian or Oma-like urbanity, one could think. But again, it's very different. That, I think, terrifically beautiful model of the Très Grande Bibliothèque of Oamé shows a notion of complexity, of composition, but where, in my opinion, empty and closed, void and mass are similar, are in equal relationship, no hierarchy. Maybe, and of course we know the Roe connection, Collage City, maybe this drawing by Collage, maybe already gives a hint to the idea of creating through infliction specific space. But then again, the complex composition is not working as a whole. It's fragments. It's a collage. The Staatsgalerie, however, seems to manage particularly well. Of course, typical picture, taken from the book which they issued when the Scots Gallery was opened in 1984, I think. The composition of its inner spaces, of all these ingredients, a lot has been said before about the Corbusian influence, evidently. A lot of these ingredients, however, creating an inner complexity, an inner scheme which, in fact, is extremely simple. It's an enfilade of rooms, and it's beautiful as it works, but it is what it is. So it's not about that. Ultimately, it's, of course, about the main protagonist, its central forum-like space, a space which, when you look from inside in the building, you seem to be part, all of a sudden, take the outside as part of the inside, the sculpture garden. But then you understand the ambiguity, that it's evidently a circulation path through the building, and it is fundamentally an attempt to contain that which you cannot contain within the building through composition. Maybe what you see you could compare with the table composition, a table with many things on top, a table where each of the elements is particular and specific, and the table, as I think you can see very well in this picture, is of course literally here, and is able to contain the complexity of the program, but is also able to contain its intricate relationship, that what you cannot define. Maybe the Sotsas table does not add much more than the sum of the ingredients. Here, in this very simplified, straightened view, as it was the cover of that book issued for the opening, you see everything condensed. You see the stair, you see the ramp, you see the entrance to the parking lot, you see the weird glass wall entrance way. You see the rotunda in the back. You see the whole set of complex elements which ultimately contain that what you cannot describe, true infliction. And then again, back at Rossi, still life on the glass table from 1971. All the objects together and their shadow, one could think, but the shadow depicts the shadow of his then lost boyfriend. Thank you.
Thank you, Kirsten, for your reading. A not so dumb architect, I should have thought. Next speaker is a very eloquent architect, writer, and architectural historian, Irénée Scalbert. Irénée taught for years at the Architectural Association School. And he also taught at the Harvard Graduate School of Design. And he's currently teaching at the Limerick School of Architecture in Ireland. He's the author of many an essay and architect and articles on architecture and of a book, A Right to Difference, The Architecture of Jean Renaudie. But for me, Irénée is especially a master in the rare exemplar of the essay. And I think we're going to have one of those now.
Thank you very much, Christoph. So I think that's some of the thing I would like to say today. I mean, will overlap actually with themes which have been touched upon by Kirsten. But I would like to start with this painting by Picasso of 1918, which is called Return from the Christening after Luna. And it is an unusual work in which Picasso transcribed figures by Luna and painted them in the manner of Georges Seurat. And as Elizabeth Cowling remarked in her excellent study of Picasso, Not only was he playing a game with somebody else's style, he was also toying with the idea that style is something personal to an artist. Now, I would like to suggest that Sterling was doing something similar. And for instance, here at the Claw Gallery, and I should say that this presentation is not really about the Claw Gallery, but it's using the place in which we are, perhaps to highlight a couple of points. And so the gallery is a modern building, and even one could say a Corbusian building in many ways. It is also a building where parts of the design, for instance, the entrance hall, were conceived in the manner of John Soane, as has already been pointed out by Christophe, you know, in some ways. And as if to reinforce the point, which I have just made, Sterling's drawings from the Claw were themselves colored, like Picasso's painting, in the manner of Georges Seurat. Okay, it was not dots, but they were dashes, but I mean, the idea was similar. Now, Picasso thought of himself as a painter without style. He shifted too much, he moved too often, and that's why he actually said he had no style. He clearly enjoyed breaking rules and adapting styles in unpredictable ways, and so did Sterling. Sterling liked to start a project with a reference or simply a sketch drawn by an assistant and then to tamper with it in his own way. And as Alexis Pontvig, a one-time assistant of Sterling, said, by starting with something already drawn up, it could be altered, distorted, enhanced, rephrased, or fragmented. Now, to approach the work of Sterling on the ground of style never fails to disappoint. At least it disappoints me. And for sure, the work is full of references and full of allusions. And besides John Soane, the Claw Gallery has been associated with the main gate of Mycenae in Greece, with Newgate Prison by George Dance, and the Scala Regia in the Vatican, and Asplund's gridded facade of the Law Courts in Gothenburg, and I'm sure one could think of many other buildings. And so critics at the time saw that the design was eclectic, and this was enough to make it fit with postmodernism. And indeed, I think that we are still at that stage where the work of Sterling is embroiled in the controversy or in the theory of postmodernism. Now, in my view, this is neither more nor less true than to claim some works by Picasso for cubism, other works by Picasso for classicism, and still others for surrealism, or for that matter, Picasso himself, as some have done, for postmodernism. But these attributions on grounds of style do not explain works by Picasso any better than they do works by Sterling. And to argue, for instance, that the skylight in the entrance hall of the Claw came from the light well in John Soane's house barely starts to explain the design. And I would like to argue that, like Picasso, Sterling actually had no style. Now, here's a comparison ends between Sterling and Picasso. I think Picasso was fickle in his imagination, and Sterling's work, by contrast, rested on something which is more solid and permanent. And an assistant of the architect even described this foundation, that is the foundation of the work, as a dogma, as a system of order, composition, and consistency. And I think the key word here for me is composition, and Kirsten has actually used it, and it recalls the values of the École des Beaux-Arts in Paris. And Sterling did actually acknowledge, though cautiously, adapt to its tradition. Now, for the architect trained at the Beaux-Arts, and here is a sketch by Henri Labrouste of 1824, and like for Stirling, for that architect of the Beaux-Arts, the sketch was actually the key, and it represented an instant vision of the program, and in the early stages of the design, it actually helped to secure the coherence of the composition. And the small size ensured that the vision of the whole could be maintained at all times, and a Beaux-Arts theorist writing as late as 1930 even suggested that the sketch should be no bigger than one's hand. A number of options were drawn at a tiny scale, and the simplest and clearest was actually selected. Now, Stirling proceeded precisely in the same way. Assistants drew options using, as Michael Wilford has recently recalled, the smallest sheets of paper possible so that the eye could encompass the whole image. Now, the central idea of the composition, its abstract character, helped to define every aspect of a project, and Stirling claimed that the cutouts in the facade of the floor exposed the veneer-like construction. But in my view, it would be more accurate to say that they actually exposed the reality of the conception. And between the cutout pediment of the claw and the shape of the auditoria at Leicester, there is, I think, a very clear affinity. And if the one presents an equivocal void, the other here presents an equivocal solid. And both, I think, belong with the shapes and the cubes that one finds in a children's nursery. And like objects in the nursery, they have no significant mass and little or no significant form. Few people actually recognize the pediment in the entrance of the claw, or for that matter, a lecture hall in the cantilevers of Leicester. What is not equivocal, however, is their presence. I think both the cutout and the auditoria are powerful objects, but it is less, I think, a physical presence graspable by the senses than it is actually a presence which is felt in the mind. And here a word might be said of the colors here at the claw that drew so much attention at the time. And so in the entrance hall, we find orange on the walls, as we do here in the lecture hall, green on the mullions, blue, or rather ultramarine and turquoise around the tall window, and indigo behind the balcony, and violet or pink on a handrail. And these colors I have mentioned include all but two colors of the spectrum, and a fact that was, I think, curiously mixed at the time by critics. Now, Stirling himself likened the claw in his opening speech here at the Tate to the Rainbow Warrior, the Greenpeace trawler that had just been sunk in harbor by the French Secret Service. Now, the color scheme of the claw, I think, could be simply expressed as O.G. Biv, and where the Roy G. Biv have the R for red and the Y for yellow actually removed. Now, this nominal approach to color found little favor at the time, and for those with a taste for intellect, a dissonance in real life triggers pleasing resonance in the mind, and it is certainly the case with me. In the entrance hall of the Chlor, there are actually plenty of dissonances. And for instance, the handrails are not matched on either side of the stairs. The spherical lamp at the landing, at the top of this image, stands beside rather than on the main axis of the stairs. And the grated side of the stairs here is out of plumb with the grated walls to the side of it and also above it. And most strikingly, a corner of the tall window frame, which you see, of course, here, is actually chopped, and no explanation for this is provided. Now, some of these dissonances may not have been designed in a formal sense, but there is no doubt in my mind that they were actually intended. Now, opinion in recent years has favored an architecture founded in the experience of the senses and in what some fashionable theorists call affects as opposed to concepts. And every conceivable experiment has been carried out with materials. And for instance, photographs have been printed onto concrete, and silkscreen printing has been used on curtain walls, and shapes have been pressed into metal, and ingenious bonds have been developed for brickwork, as I think is currently happening at Tate Modern. Expression in architecture, it is assumed by many people today, starts and ends on the surface of building. And to most, this will be just common sense. But I wonder whether it is as obvious as we tend to think. Now, that buildings are designed in order to be experienced, there is, of course, no doubt whatsoever, but what a building actually expresses, I think, is a different question. Now, the architect determines the character of a building. This is, of course, his role. And at one end of the expressive scale, a building shall flatter the senses, as we see here on the screen. And this has been, by and large, the preference in recent years. Now, at the other end of the expressive scale, a building can engage the mind. And Stirling, I think, worked closest to this end of the scale than most. And there is little in his work that is soft or warm. Details are sparse and often oversized. Colors shock before they ingratiate, and spaces evoke geometry and abstraction before they actually do inhabitation. But in all cases, I think the expression is always forceful and always distinctive. And to take, for instance, the tall window in the entrance hall, a peculiar and, I think, a fascinating object. Now, it makes no specific reference to history or to style, and it has no recognizable symbolic purpose, at least not one that I know. And it merely draws attention to itself and, of course, to the entrance to the galleries beyond. The profile of its frame is so blunt that it hardly qualifies as molding. And like an edicule, it is engaged in the wall, but part of the frame is actually freestanding. And the frame suggests actually no particular material, not timber, not stone, and it stands out on the strengths of its colors alone. And beyond the frames, thing gets even more strange with a three-sided prism, which you see just a part of on the top left, and a passage, of course, below, that have both of them have little to do with the window and with its elevation. Add to this the fact that the window is actually seldom seen as a whole, except as one walks downstairs. And of course, by then, as one walks downstairs, the explicit purpose of the window, which is to guide the visitor upstairs to the gallery, has already been spent. Clearly, it does not correspond to a specific viewpoint, except the mind's eye of the architect. And this expression, the mind's eye of the architect, has actually been used by Michael Wilford recently. So you could say that the window is, as Le Corbusier, I mean, to use a phrase of Le Corbusier, a pure construction of the mind. But unlike anything that Le Corbusier did, it is cheerfully imperfect. It seems comfortable and even monumental in a situation that is, I would suggest, gleefully lacking in consistency. And it is, I think, a beautiful object, and what that shows as often with Stirling, a keen presence of mind. Presence of mind, I think, goes well with the architect, and a keen presence of mind in the world that is almost, by definition, short of it. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Irene, for making us look at this building. Final speaker today is Patrick Lynch, architect in London, and also one of the authors of an article in the Oise issue. Patrick has also taught at the Architectural Association and at UCD in Dublin. And he's currently teaching a diploma unit at London Metropolitan University. But I guess most importantly for him at the moment, he's got a series of schemes quite nearby in Victoria. I'm very happy that Patrick could come and speak to us, despite being under huge pressure on that one.
Thank you very much, Christoph. Let's get some water. The talk's in two parts. The first part is somebody born towards the end of the 20th century trying to imagine what it was like to have been born at the beginning of the 20th century. And the second part of the talk is somebody who's trying to imagine what the future might be like on that basis, i.e. if there was a way in which, as architects, we couldn't in this country keep murdering the father and forgetting every 20 years everything that the previous generation had learnt, which I think is a particular problem in England. Although the problem of memory in the 20th century, I think, is one of the major topics of art and of criticism. And of course, this image is used by Stirling in one of the comparative essays that he wrote, giving us hints at what he'd been looking at, things that comprise his own personal memory collection. And you kind of get the sense with Stirling in particular that he's not so much inventing things as remembering things, or as if he's kind of putting his hand into a bag and finding the thing, the style for the job. This is Giorgio de Chirico, of course. And I imagine that if you were born 100 years ago, you'd probably still have the prejudice of thinking that the train has just arrived in the city, as it were. The city is enduring, has been there for a long time. And the juxtaposition of technology and what, by that point, one imagines from this tension that de Chirico's recording has become something quite static in architecture, a kind of copy of a copy of a copy, creates a kind of imbalance. And it's that tension or imbalance which Stirling seems to be obsessed with as a young man. The origins of modernism are as conflicted, I would say, as the origins of postmodernism. Mark this morning suggested that you could easily move postmodernism back to the 50s in an English context. Joseph Rickvert talks about the architects of the Ecole des Beaux-Arts being the architects of the first moderns, Durand's notion of functionalism, for example. The attempt by Stirling, I think, to try and find a way not to balance but to allow in tension the things that he admired, both industrial architecture and art, I suppose he calls it, picks up on one extremely interesting figure that bypassed almost everybody else in this country, and that's Giorgio Meletti. Now, I would argue that the holding in tension of industrial buildings and buildings which have a representational content came to Stirling very easily because of the nature of Liverpool as a city which is made, not into which technology is placed, but a city which grows from technology. So you see here a merchant's house, which is also a warehouse. There's no bourgeois distinction made, as you would find in other 19th century cities. They're embedded within each other. And those twin images are something that, of course, Tony Vidler draws our attention to in the catalogue of the photographs upstairs, which I think have formed the flyer for this event, of the Oast houses. Two things to note here. One is that for a northerner coming to London looking for an identity which is not, I mean, weirdly, it's probably more refined than the guys trained at the AA because he's been taught by Rowe, who's been taught by Witkowa, so he knows more. But he's got to find a way to mediate that because he's not been to a good public school. He's not been to an establishment university. And so what Tony Vidler's suggestion is that W.H. Auden, who's also a northerner, offers a kind of way to be romantic but also not to appear effete. On the other hand, the reaction Stirling is having against Neo-Palladianism, which he sees as a kind of attempt at creating an English tradition out of nothing, leads him towards some very interesting figures. The suggestion is from his good friend George Melly that he was also interested in Dylan Thomas and Bertolt Brecht, and that there's a sense of something authentically British in industrial buildings, which is different to the academic tradition of Neo-Palladianism or the landowning classes. And at the same time, we know that as well as this kind of romanticism occurring in English culture at the time, there's one can think of Benjamin Britten, Peter Grimes, John Piper's paintings, etc. There's also a sense that this vernacular is something modern. It's not something that can be considered outside of the Industrial Revolution. And so he's not taking these things as evidence, I think, of nationalism in the way in which a lot of English architects in the 80s, for example, were aligning the British engineering tradition with money and power and empire and high tech. there's a kind of unease, I think. There's almost humorous, ironic ambivalence about this thing, which is a kind of tension that other people have described today as almost being schizophrenic. I don't know this guy, but he's really quite good, I think. He's a young researcher at the AA, and he's just written about a letter that Colin Rowe wrote to Louis Kahn, kind of explaining to Louis Kahn in Rowe's interpretation how to design. And what he does is he redraws a plan of I think it's the Palazzo Farnese, not as an object with figures in it, or figures with grounds in it, but as a continuous series of ambivalent thresholds. And the thresholds which look forwards and look backs temporally, spatially, things which reveal things that you can't see when you're going towards them, but you can only understand retrospectively, is something that seems to be at the heart of the condition of modernism. That modernism is not oriented towards the future, or if it is, it's walking backwards towards it. And so the suggestion that Fiddler's making, there's a kind of awkwardness, is clear also in his very good friend Colin St. John Wilson's writings about the things that are left out of traditional understandings of modernism. And in particular, the seminal essay by T.S. Eliot about tradition and individual talent, about the role that tradition plays in formulating paradigm shifts and individual work, is enables us, I think, to make another reading of the tension in de Chirico's paintings, which is that you could actually imagine, from our kind of jaundiced point of view now, perhaps, that we accept that the train came first, but that something else arrives as well. And it's that, I think, which all creative people are sensitive to, and it's that which we sense when we respond creatively to that which is unsaid, that which is left intention in modern compositions, music, painting, and poetry, and architecture, I would suggest, that it's not something that can be predicted wholly by functionalism. This I know this quote because of reading a novel by the Canadian novelist Robertson Davis, the Deptford Trilogy, which similarly kind of looks back and forth. It's hinged on the period of modernity and industrialization, aspirations of three generations of Scottish immigrants to Ontario, I think it is. And that there's something that remains which cannot be spoken about, which cannot be drawn, perhaps, but which can be reacted to. Le Corbusier also suffers in Anglo-Saxon context from a peculiar reading of him, which anybody who opens any of Corbusier's books would realize you wouldn't recognize the man if you only read English criticisms of him. The key to this, I think, is that it's the unpredictability of things, and yet the owl has found its own way here without being called. It seems to be what architecture aspires to, is the creation of things which are memorable and appear recognizable, and yet they haven't existed before. And of course, recent scholarship about Corbusier points to the fact that he was similarly eclectic, and the regional, the mythic, the archetypal, the surreal are juxtaposed. The useful, the everyday, and the fantastical exist together at once. And as well as being a painter, de Quirico wrote a novel called Hebdomeros, which bizarrely is on the website of the novelist, postmodern novelist, Thomas Pynchon. The book starts with a description of a kind of modern setting. Not a melancholy, but a kind of boredom. And the book ends with, Hebdomeros, trying to go back. Meeting the figure of immortality. She spoke no more. Seated on the fragment of a broken column, she gently placed one hand on his shoulder and the other took hold of the hero's right hand. Hebdomeros' elbow leaning on the ruined column and his chin leaning on his hand, thought no longer. Blah, 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 blah. Immortality, or the things taking on a life of their own beyond the mind of the person that imagined them, which seems to be the thing which great art achieves, is described here as long strings of sublime birds, white and immaculate, flew by singing. And there's obviously there's a kind of secular mythological dimension to the work of Dylan Thomas, and one could imagine that, as Fiddler leads us to see, that as a bird watcher, there's a kind of romantic aspect of 20th century relationship with the natural world that's kind of mediated via technology. And we're distanced from the world. We have hobbies that reconnect us to the world. And of course, architecture is one way to acknowledge the difficult condition of immortality. Now, I think that one problem of the 20th century is it's obviously man's difficult relationship with getting old. People like Leather Baron and Mostafa have been writing about weathering in architecture over the past decades. And yet, the modern architecture, by being so fixated on the future and being so fixated on its own perfection, seems to forget that it goes out of fashion and it dies. But another problem, and a deeper problem, I think, might be that the problem of making buildings that don't, making buildings that will endure after one's died. And in effect, what's happening today is a kind of immortality for Stirling, because this work has gone out of fashion, but it's clearly got deeper dimensions intrinsic to it than simply the fashion of postmodernism. And I think he becomes aware of this. You look at the way the ground is higher than the columns. It's almost as if the modern man has arrived into a scene that he's not invented, he's inherited. And I've got a few kind of provocative fragments to suggest, and I'm going to read you something and show you some imagery that points backwards and points forwards. Auden wrote the obituary for Stravinsky, and he claimed the difference between a minor artist and a major artist is that a minor artist, you can't date their work when you look at their oeuvre, because it's all the same. Whereas a great artist exhausts ideas and moves on. And of course there are continuities, and part of the role of historians is to trace those evolutions of thinking. This is a very different ontological view to the dominant view of the architect as somebody with a signature style who's a genius who's going to simply repeat themselves. It's a very different view than the people that Stirling would have encountered and that one still kind of encounters at the AA, for example. Um, I'm not sure whether it's correct to say, as I suggested in my Awaz article, that Sterling has always been interested in landscapes and figures. You could read Camberwell as a hill with some figures on it. You could read the Staatsgalerie in the same way. The composition for Churchill College echoes these themes. It's probably trite to say one of the problems of modernism is not just the problem of dying, it's also the problem of drowned, which might be the same thing in certain readings of it. And that Colin Rose's distaste for modernism is that it creates in architecture isolated objects which have no relationship to the city, and that perhaps that's what guides Sterling to make the ground and to make typological figures which organize one's perception of a new place as a city. I'm not sure that that's entirely all the story, and I'm going to show you one more image. I can make this thing work. So you could argue there's continuity all the way through. There's making the site, there's building a collection of recognizable fragments that, in your mind, create an uneasy whole. On the other hand, there might be another way to think about this, which is that one of the key problems for us who are not born into the traditional city and are not yet born into some future city where memory has been erased by technology, is that any attempt to recreate that whole doesn't ring true. It rings hollow, in fact. And that perhaps what is continuous in Sterling's work is an existential anxiety about the whole. And so, for example, one could say that his projects could be described as wall types or as earthworks. But in each instance, they're always undermined, literally undermined, by the human figure moving through them and experiencing them. And as a kind of joke or game, what I'd like to do is take seriously Tony Vidler's suggestion that this large man who collected chairs was actually interested in poetry, and trying to find words that don't resolve tension but offer not balance but a kind of asymmetry or isotropia to it, is the idea that land is very important and landscape is very important in Sterling's architecture. Now, what follows next is a visual essay. I haven't been able to write anything over the past few weeks, but what I'd like to try and draw to your attention is the tension that exists in his work between the creation of images and the undermining of their stability, and the creation of landscapes and their undermining, and the creation of territories, which are things that I think constitute type of creativity which isn't personal to him. And the architect with no style, or the guy looking for the style for the job, is a very different way of thinking about creativity than some weak versions of modernism suggest. And as a consequence, it's possible to talk about now a generation of architects who've been influenced by him and by Constance John Wilson. And also, I don't want to just try to kind of reach for another tradition in the way Constance John Wilson tries to invoke a kind of northern precedent, because I think that Manetti is key because he's the guy who enables Sterling to deal with Rome not as Colin Rose historical version of it, but as something which is a type of modernism that's grounded in its relationship to land and ground in relationship to the city and to temperature. And I'm going to show some slides, I'm going to read the poem, and there's some images by some architects working today in of my generation and some of my own projects, some here, some not here, that I think suggest that there's a continuity of relationship with the past. The poem I'm going to read is called In Praise of Limestone. If it form the one landscape that we, the inconstant ones, are consistently homesick for, this is chiefly because it dissolves in water. Mark these rounded slopes with their surface fragrance of time, and beneath a secret system of caves and conduits. Hear the springs that spurt out everywhere with a chuckle, each filling a private pool for its fish and carving its own little ravine whose cliffs entertain the butterfly and the lizard. Examine this region of short distances and definite places. What could be more like mother or a fitter background for her son? The flirtatious male who lounges against a rock in the sunlight, never doubting that for all his faults, he is loved, whose works are but extensions of his power to charm. From weathered outcrop to hilltop temple, from appearing waters to conspicuous fountains, from a wild to a formal vineyard, our ingenious but short steps that a child's wish to receive more attention than his brothers, whether by pleasing or teasing, can easily take. Watch then the band of rivals as they climb up and down their steep stone gennels in twos and threes, at times arm in arm, but never, thank God, in step, or engaged on the shady side of a square at midday in voluble discourse, knowing each other too well to think that there are any important secrets. Unable to conceive a god whose temper tantrums are moral, and not to be pacified by a clever line or a good lay. For accustomed to a stone that responds, they have never had to veil their faces in awe of a crater whose blazing fury could not be fixed. Adjusted to the local needs of valleys where everything can be touched or reached by walking, their eyes have never looked into infinite space. Through the lattice work of a nomad's comb, born lucky, their legs have never encountered the fungi and insects of the jungle, the monstrous forms and lives with which we have nothing, we like to hope, in common. So, when one of them goes to the bad, the way his mind works remains comprehensible. Become a pimp, or deal in fake jewelry, or ruin a fine tenor voice for effects that bring the house down, could all happen to all but the best and the worst of us. That is why, I suppose, the best and worst never stayed here long, but sought immoderate soils where the beauty was not so external, the light less public, and the meaning of life something more than a mad camp. Come, cried the granite wastes, how evasive is your humour, how accidental your kindest kiss, how permanent is death, saints to be slipped away sighing. Come, purred the clays and gravels. On our plains, there is room for armies to drill, rivers wait to be tamed, and slaves to construct you a tomb in the grand manner. Soft as the earth is mankind, and both need to be altered. Intendant sees us rose and left, slamming the door. But the really reckless were fetched by an older, colder voice, the oceanic whisper, I am the solitude that asks and promises nothing. That is how I shall set you free. There is no love. There are only the various envies, all of them sad. They were right, my dear. All those voices were right and still are. This land is not the sweet home that it looks, nor its peace, the historical calm of a site where something was settled once and for all. A backward and dilapidated province, connected to the big, busy world by a tunnel, with a certain seedy appeal. Is that all it is now? Not quite. It has a worldly duty, which in spite of itself it does not neglect, but calls into question all the great powers assume. It disturbs our rights. The poet, admired for his earnest habit of calling the sun, his mind puzzle, is made uneasy by these marble statues, which so obviously doubt his anti-mythological myth, and these gamins, pursuing the scientist down the tiled colonnade with such lively offers, rebuke his concerns for nature's remotest aspects. I too am reproached for what and how much you know, not to lose time, not to get caught, not to be left behind, not please to resemble the beasts who repeat themselves, or a thing like water or stone whose conduct can be predicted. These are our common prayer, whose greatest comfort is music, which can be made anywhere, is invisible and does not smell. Insofar as we have to look forward to death as a fact, no doubt we are right. But if sins can be forgiven, if bodies rise from the dead, these modifications of matter into innocent athletes and gesticulating fountains, made surely solely for pleasure, make a further point. The blessed will not care what angle they are regarded from, having nothing to hide. Dear, I know nothing of either, but when I try to imagine a faultless love or the life to come, what I hear is the murmur of underground streams. What I see is a limestone landscape. Thank you.
Can we have some light? Patrick, Irene, and Kirsten to come to the fore. Well, let's see if after the poetic ruminations, we go back to questions. Are there any from the floor? Brian, please.
This is to do with Gestalt and Gestalt psychology. Bolton mentions Gestalt in the New Year letter, and I think he knew Kohler in New York. He's one of the pioneers of Gestalt psychology. Venturi also in one of his writings pays great attention to the examples from Gestalt psychology. Now, the word Gestalt has been used to this morning, I think, to be identified with a strong image, strong Gestalt. But of course, the whole point about Gestalt psychology was the emphasis on figure and ground, and the equivocation between the two, and certainly. A great deal of Venturi's thought turns around what exactly is figure and what is ground, as Colin Rose later on. And it seems to me that this cusp of equivocation as to what is figure and what is ground seems to be a situation in which a great many of the turns in Sterling's work appears. I mean, for instance, the example that Irene showed as between the cantilever at Leicester and the gateway here, which is positive, which is negative, which is solid, which is ground, and so on. I wonder if you might take this theme up.
Yeah, I guess the first thought which comes to my mind is that figure and ground is generally something which is associated with the plan. And not only that, I think it is generally something which is associated with urban plans, the cities and urban plans and so on. And I guess that's, you know, also brings to mind something which Christoph said at the very beginning about the relationship between the work of Stirling and the city. And for me, the way I spontaneously look at this relationship between void and solid, or figure and ground, in the work of Stirling is in terms of composition. It's not even in terms of architecture, but in terms of composition, almost like an architect, like an artist might. And I guess what you are, you know, it's a question also that you're asking of the field which you're suggesting. Raised to me the status, you know, a question about the status of composition in the work of Stirling, and to what extent Stirling is an artist, an architect, and an urban designer, or perhaps even a planner. And I guess I think that we probably all have different ideas on this.
Well, let's try to see if we have different ideas. I mean, I feel reminded, I'm not sure whether that answers your question, but I feel reminded of some of the conversations we had when doing the Oase issue on what was the essential difference between, say, James Stirling on the one hand and, say, Ungers or Rossi on the other. Mm-hmm. Yeah? And because, you know, you could say there are obvious similarities. They have certain concerns, or they seem to have certain concerns, which they share about what they want to deal with, which is, say, the context of a city. But the method of looking and the method of working seems to be so utterly different. You know, where really it's not only that the work of Stirling is far less, as it were, predictable, but it's also, there's clearly a sort of element of composition in there which doesn't come out of a system, which is clearly coming from something else.
I'm not sure if I'm answering the question, of course. But
no, but I mean, please go.
I'll try. I think, first of all, if the comparison you make, I think for me, in Stirling, and it's an obvious difference, I think there's no theory. Stirling is not a theoretical person. I mean, there's, of course, he's surrounded by people with all kind of theories, but he's not having a theory on his own. At least that's how I always have approached him. And by not having a theory, I think he's, but for in the danger of seeing something which is extremely imprecise, I think he's a composer. He makes a piece, or a piece out of different set of pieces. And I think, in that sense, he's extremely not ideological. I mean, even though I try to make a comparison with Venturi's Difficult Hole, it's no accident that Venturi wrote about the Difficult Hole and Stirling made the Difficult Hole. I mean, he would not have, it wouldn't have been the opposite way around. And in that sense, I think Venturi was an ideologist, or is an ideologist, he's still around. And Stirling is not. And but at the same time, and that's also why I used the Hockney paintings and things like that. I think that ultimately that makes his work somehow multi-interpretable. It's based on a lot of hunches. And as such, I think it survives a certain interpretation. So in that regard, I think he's, for me, much closer to the artist author, but in my opinion, many good architects are, then he's a proper urbanist. At the same time, I believe that due to the scale of certain projects, he was able to incorporate the urban within the very precise field of his intervention. It's as if he allowed the city within his perimeter, but he did not really interfere on something outside of that perimeter. I think it's very particular.
Would you agree if I said that actually the relationship between the building and the city got better over time? I found it very interesting to see. I looked at the Roma Interrotta drawings again, and of course, you know, you have a sort of almost catalogue of buildings by Sterling. What struck me is that actually the later buildings, even in the sort of collage, if you like, seem to be more successful and actually sort of stating themselves on the ground than some of the earlier ones. If you look at how, for example, the Oxford and Cambridge buildings are sort of linked to the Tiber, that's far less successful than some of the later work.
Yeah, but I think to a certain extent that has even to do with the question, right? I mean,
university
buildings
were
university campuses, so you glue them in Roma Interrotta plan, and they in a way have the same relationship. I mean, you can find a smart connection with what's found on the map, but that's about it. Whereas, obviously, the projects he did in Germany had that implicit idea. But even there, I think it's harder to disconnect the German projects from their context, so hence they're very site-specific.
Yeah.
And it's much easier to disconnect the older buildings. So it's as if the framework around the building, and there's always a very explicit framework, I think also in Düsseldorf, also in Köln, is almost more important as a figure than the actual objects on the frame or on the tableau. And I did not specifically talk about it today, but that gave me the hunch at least to connect it, with, you could say, the idea, which is of course very common also in pop art, to deal with the common and deal with reality, but do that within using the rules of your own game. And that I like very much about Irene Scalbert's take on the Clore Gallery, because in some ways, maybe that's my interpretation of his presentation, but for me he said the same. There's a very heavy and, in my opinion, underestimated pop aspect to Sterling, but in a positive way, like the way we look at Ed Rocher paintings, the way we would look at David Hockney paintings, stuff like that.
Well, I presume somewhere there is something which could be described as pop, but I suppose for me what strikes me most and which I enjoy especially, and perhaps that goes back to Brian's question about solid and void and figure and ground. It's a project which perhaps for me is the most intriguing and possibly the most exciting in urban terms. It's a very last ones, competitions in Japan. For instance, you know, the one in Nara, which looks like cubes which have been piled one on top of each other in composition, which looks, on the one hand, which do look childlike, and at the same time, which look very urban. And actually, I don't find actually such figure and ground are so prominent in the work of Sterling. I cannot actually, off the top of my mind, think of so many drawings which actually show the object in black and the rest in white, or vice versa.
I think that's probably why it's simply because you showed it today. So there's a reaction to these, to your point about the entrance here and the. I'm just wondering whether everybody is just sitting there and thinking it's all going very well, but we're not. We're doing something else, or whether we would like to actually do what this is supposed to be, which is also asking questions. Are there any questions? Because otherwise, we just go on for a bit.
you talk about James not being a theorist, but then is half the problem his kind of desire to see rhetoric and form hand in hand, and that he doesn't need to do that. When he needed to make money, he wrote articles in the 50s about Corbyn things, and he almost didn't need to. He could build it instead, whereas people like Rossi and Ungers have less of an output, maybe, than James ever did.
Who did not have to make money? I'm sorry, I didn't.
Yeah, I mean, in terms of he didn't need to write for a lot of period, or he chose not to, and he taught instead.
Sterling did not need to, I'm sorry, not so such a big fan. Sterling did not need to write. Yes, but I mean, I don't dismiss that. I think there's people who write and people who don't write. It's not an issue. I mean, if I say that he was not a theorist, I think that's great. I like architects which are not really theorists, I mean, but somehow seem to accumulate a certain knowledge through their work. So if that's what you're asking, it's not a critique or criticism. It's purely, it's a fact. You know, there's no proper ideology. And I think that's also powerful about it. But maybe you wanted to ask a question related to that, or not?
Normally people who say that, they're almost putting him down.
Hmm?
They normally put him down, you know, they treat him very badly by saying he's not an intellectual or he couldn't write. And
but you see, I'm not an intellectual myself, so it's normal that I like it, you see? No, honestly, I think it's important. I think there's a very big distinction between people who wrote texts and then desperately tried to make architecture in order to prove them right, and people who made architecture.
What do you mean, like Rossi?
Yeah, Rossi.
And Venturi. I would strongly disagree with this, because we are sort of comparing apples and pears.
No,
I mean, the thing is that, of course, you also have to take into account the very different academic cultures. I mean, in both Germany and in Italy, if you teach in architecture schools, and it doesn't matter whether you're actually a practicing architect or whether you are more of a historian, you will be required to express yourself and actually sort of do research. And certainly in Italy, at the time when Rossi was working in academia, it was simply required from him to do these things. Now, the fact that that isn't exactly the case in England, and especially, you know, although Sterling, of course, was working at a time when people did write, but nobody actually wrote, as it were, academic stuff. Nobody did, in that sense, sort of the sort of research that was done at the time in both Germany and Italy. I think the context is very, very different here. You know, you get away with a cultural model which makes you get away with different kind of production.
Yeah, of course, but I mean, as I
so
said,
I mean,
it's
sort of.
But it's not the value. It's not about the value of that. I think it's. I believe that, and also when we were making the issue for Wazak, I think what's very important is that, in some way, when you accumulate knowledge through the making of projects, whether they're built or not, I think the knowledge you accumulate is another kind of knowledge. I mean, whether you want it or not. Yeah. And I think, as a consequence, that body of work of Sterling, and I don't see at all any difference between the beginning or the end or anything. I don't see a difference between, it has been said before this sentence, the style for the job, which I believe is a Gowan thing, and then there's Sterling. He's a classicist. Fine.
Well, I mean, there are quite a few ways of being, of engaging theory. I wouldn't necessarily call Sterling, an architect with a strong taste for theory. However, I think that Sterling's work strikes me as being very intellectual, in the sense that it is, you look at it, you are in it, and it feels like it is full thought. And one does get a sense of Sterling, you know, when he draws, being very thoughtful. And for me, it seems to be the form of theory. So drawings, to me, the beautiful drawings which are upstairs, especially the small ink drawing, to me are works of theory. At least I like to look upon them that way. And certainly when I was a student, as I'm sure with many, many people,
they were enormously influential, and I'd like to think that it was not because those drawings were being imitated, but because they were truly inspirational as opening, you know, a field of inquiry.
Mm-hmm. No, I agree with that, I can imagine. I mean, but that's quite different from writing a manifesto and making something
accordingly. The only time I've ever met anybody recently talk to me about Gestalt theory is to do with Steiner schools, because I know some people who send their kids to Rudolf Steiner schools, and the education there seems to be based on play, and I think this is has something to do with what we're talking about, which is that if you're an architect, work and play are often quite similar things, because you have to solve a problem, which is work, but you've solved that problem before, but perhaps it's a south-facing slope rather than a north-facing slope. It's a bit like playing billiards or pool. You know how to play a screw shot, but you've got to play a screw shot from the other end of the table in the dark, and you have to, you know what I mean, you're playing something and you're constantly oscillating between things which you've recognised already and problems that you have a kind of muscle memory of knowing how to solve, but you have to solve them always differently. And I think there is a difference between the architects who, for whatever reason, wrote books as manifestos and then at the end stuck their work in it as a way to try and prove the theory, as opposed to somebody who playfully, like Stirling and arguably Le Corbusier, produces books which themselves are an argument. And the argument is represented in the book, but the book isn't the actual modus operandi of their of their inquiry. As I mean, Vitruvius is similar, so is Alberti, obviously. They're kind of they're records of something. And of course he's kind of making a homage to Corbusier. He wants to be public. I think there's a similar tension at the moment, which seems to be really ridiculous, is that Zaha Hadid seems to be the most intuitive architect, and yet Schumacher's written some bizarre book that tries to justify and theorise something, and you get kind of caught in this endless oscillation, whereas I think that what Stirling shows to us is that there's a kind of playful wit and intelligence at play that is palpable. You can feel it. You know, you can feel it when you stand there, and the asymmetry of the room suddenly makes sense, where the cornice is cut and it's not here, and you feel yourself walking into something that somebody has prepared for you. It's both kind of physical feeling and an intellectual feeling at the same time, which is a kind of playfulness that perhaps some architects don't ever become very playful because they haven't mastered the game. And thus, one of the problems with the endless production of theory today is it's a kind of as if people are constantly trying to invent new games with new rules. And
is that true? I mean, I don't have the idea that there's that much theory around, except me at this moment. It's gone seriously out of fashion. I mean, let's not even talk about Zaha's authorship or not, because we don't know who actually wrote these things.
She didn't write
or
them.
We sort of, yeah. I mean, the fact is that texts by Stirling are clearly by Stirling. They're not written by anyone else. There's not a ghostwriter or anything. So there's an authentic voice there. Yeah. Florian. Hang on. Who's got the mic first? Then first Florian, then Bob Maxwell, please.
Maybe I'm saying the obvious. I mean, I think he is just an architect and an architect and an architect. And this is something quite rare today, because I don't think many buildings out there are made by architects, real architects. And by real architect, I mean, is an architect who does design as research, mm-hmm. and who questions every time, how these columns should join the ceiling, every time, and and trying to find a new answer. And he uses a drawing as a research. I mean, they're doing that in this office. They have done wonderful drawings, and some you can see in the Tate downstairs. And they are going into history and look at the history, but then make translations. This is hard work, making translations of the history into contemporary methods of productions and so on. And he likes furniture as architecture and city as architecture. And and I think that is, you know, what I think could be called playing. And it's architect of poetry and passion. Yeah. This is what it is for me.
Well, I something slightly proved in by the afternoon. But was this a question or just an observation?
Observation.
Okay. In that case, perhaps...
My question is directed at Patrick. Sorry. Is it... I forget his name.
First
guy on the right.
Patrick. That is Patrick, yes.
Patrick Lynch.
Patrick Lynch, yes.
Patrick, I was very moved by your final reading of that poem and all the fragments of architecture we looked at. And it occurred to me, I've always presented Stirling as a master of mannerism and a kind of expert at the game. But when I saw those statues in the court of the Staatsgalerie and you associated them with Di Chirico's frenzied figures, with the train passing in the distance, it made me think that there is something in Stirling that I hadn't realized. Could it be a sense, a dawning sense of the tragic? Is there some tragedy in Stirling?
I think your definition of mannerism as keeping your cool is very brilliant, because I think that's correct. But I would read Stirling as Baroque, because he leads us to that impression, you know, the people that he draws our attention to, and that has a kind of drama to it, and theatricality, and involvement, which is emotional. And I think that you can see some architects playing games, and you can see other people who are, that there's something at stake, something at risk. And I think that there's another way to look at it. He's not just creating tragic scenes. I think he's also creating comic scenes, which, we seem to, Peter Carl always points out, we seem to have got very good at being able to depict the tragic scene, Serlio's tragic scene. It's lamentable, and you know, kind of the city is void of everyday life and humour and people. But I think that Stirling's attention to juxtaposition has comedy in it as well as tragedy. But I think that the tragedy is a kind of 20th century type of tragedy, which is linked to the individual's experience. And I think that Irénée has captured something that, and you were talking about this kind of almost parallax experience of something that cannot be remarked upon, cannot be seen, cannot be shared almost as a spectacle, which is perhaps why it's not entirely correct to call it Baroque, which is the tragic operates. It's only after a series of things have been played out do you realise, ah. And I think that his work definitely operates on that level, where if spectacle as in architecture becomes a kind of perspectival game where everything is presented to you one after the other, and there's no hierarchy to it, there's no sense of time existing before or after, or there's no sense of anticipation, there's no sense of something being left open for you to realize afterwards. I think that's tragic, that there's something that can't be said, that needs to be made up anew.
So in other words, there's a sort of incompleteness,
yeah,
which is left open, and it could be tragic.
There's a question. The lady in row number four.
After listening to all this, I don't know, but to me, he's more like oniric instead of tragic. I think he has some kind of some naughty essence or something that will do some... orange or red or pink or whatever, and it's kind of a dream like that he wants to express something that it's not like the real life pattern, everything. I don't know.
Well, obviously, he's an architect onto which a lot of things can be projected have been.
I mean, I shared, in a way, I don't know whether I share your comment or your instinct, because I must say that I find difficult in the work of Sterling to associate it with a specific mood, be it tragic or comic or any other. And, for instance, you know, in the entrance hall here of the Clore or in this auditorium, unlike many spaces I could think of, you know, for instance, a space by John Soane, which are very moody and over quite a broad range, I think in the work of Sterling, I find this kind of projection or understanding or appreciation difficult. And I'm not quite sure why it is. I mean, to me, to say that Sterling was just playing with bits like handrails and so on wouldn't quite explain it. I think there is clearly something more going there. But whether, you know, Sterling, and maybe somebody here in this room will know, but I mean, whether Sterling was actually proceeding to actually create a kind of specific atmosphere, I'm not so sure, actually. And perhaps because this is something which is so strong in today's architecture, some architects anyway, are very, very motivated with precisely doing this, creating specific, highly deliberate atmosphere in certain spaces. You know. I mean, I find that there is a dry quality in the interiors of James Sterling, which is very special and which actually I like. But whether it has a mood is something I would need to think about. Yeah.
I wonder, Irene, if you could expand a little more on what you mean by cerebral presence, because I'm not sure whether it's something that you arrive with or receive on the spot or go away with, or whether it's all of those.
Well, it's a bit, maybe it's like walking into a puzzle. And, you know, maybe I can think of a puzzle, a three-dimensional puzzle on a very grand scale, and that you walk in it, and that somehow, the more you look at it, the more it actually demands to be resolved. And so this, the architecture seems to ask questions. Maybe it is something to do with my understanding of the work as being, and I say this as a French person, very intellectual, and that it's I find it is an architecture which is making canons and which is raising questions. I think whether it is doing this with everyone, for instance, those one is used to call the general public, is a different question. But certainly, you know, with people like Stirling and people around him, and maybe architects generally, that is, I think it is his capacity of being, you know, so I mean, I find the work unsettled. I think it's that, for instance, most people who are unsettling, most people who saw, for instance, a Leicester and engineering building for the first time of whatever age, find the building shocking, surprising, and the building doesn't settle in the mind easily and rapidly. And I find it is the same with many projects by Stirling, and I would include the Clore. I think that the controversy, for instance, which went on for a very long time about the colors, for instance, at the Clore is saying something similar. Is that the colors, for instance, talking about something very specific, were asking questions, and the questions took a bloody long time to settle. Yeah.
Do you think they have settled?
Well, we should ask Penelope, I think.
It seems that there's often in this question elegiac quality, and it, in a way, it's very much about the monument and the monumental, but normally monuments remind you of something and you know what you're being reminded of. And here there seems to be a kind of, we're oscillating between pulling something out of your memory which you can recognize it, and then actually which you can't name. And I mean, Patrick seemed to be talking a lot about, or coming towards to death, with the monument and the tombstone. You showed a lot of imagery of the ground and the tomb. And I don't know whether you really ultimately feel that we are somewhere in that realm.
Personally, I don't, but maybe something I don't see. What I enjoy about Stirling, and it's great for somebody who likes to write about architecture, is that it forces me to think and occasionally to write. So I think for me, one of the pleasures of Stirling, and one of the pleasures actually of many buildings, is when they are enigmas. And I think Stirling is a very enigmatic figure. It's very clearly, he must have been a very enigmatic man. And I think his work is in itself very enigmatic. One is wondering where actually the kernel of it is. And for that reason, one can think about it for a very long time, and probably people will for a very, very long time. But there is another aspect, and that would be a different way of answering your question, which is perhaps, you know, through the link with composition, and that it is a building that, I mean, there are projects, buildings, which for me are highly composed, and where this effort, this work of composition is actually visible in the architecture itself. And that's perhaps, you know, what I was trying to say when I was talking about the presence of mind, you know, the very strong presence of mind in the work, that you actually see expressed in the work the labor of actually making it. And I guess, if anything, that's probably more along those lines, that I feel that the work is mindful, is intellectual, and is so almost diametrically opposed to, I would say, 95% of the work which is being done today, which is meant to be experienced right there on the surface. Did that?
We've got a series of questions here.
Well, can we start with Emmanuel, perhaps? Can we do a triangle, Claire, Brian?
I have a problem with two notions that are in the space this afternoon. One is the status of the intellectual. What does it mean to be intellectual? The other one is, what is theory and theory's relation to doing architecture? I find that we need a lot of theorizing to understand that we don't need theory. And I find that a little bit absurd. I mean, we wouldn't be talking here if we thought that theory was not relevant to what we do as architects. And concerning this question of the intellectual, is Stirling an intellectual architect or not? I find that very hard to assess as long as we don't open up the notion of the intellect to a more finer grain of what it means to be intellectual. I would propose that Stirling is certainly not the cerebral kind of architect that one would find in somebody like, I would say, an Eisenman, for instance. Mm-hmm. But I would propose that he might be witty, that he might use wit in the sense that a post-structuralist, Jean-Luc Nancy, described. He said, what wit operates like alchemy, meaning the ingredients that go into the attempt to make gold, to make architecture, they are well known. It's hair, it's spit, it's excrements, it's well known. It's the column, it's the, all the stuff that is known, that is quite basic. And you have to trust that by recombining in a heuristic way these known ingredients, some gold might come out. And and in alchemy, it never happens, right? It's the trust that keeps you going. And I feel that model of a heuristic, witty approach to recombining materials that are, in fact, banal enough, stairs, columns and walls and what have you, that there is this this trust that may be through happy accidents that can be tragic sometimes, by the way, can express themselves tragically without anticipating those results, that you trust that architecture could happen. So I think in that sense, he was intellectual in the sense that he was witty. He knew how to put stuff together, hopeful that gold might come out.
Well, let's go back to the two notions. I mean, perhaps the panel can also react. I mean, first of all, there's the question of the intellectual. The second is the question of theory.
I agree with you. I think that's, I mean, of course, in this quick answer question, you lose the nuance. But I think the word witty, as you just introduced, I think that covers it pretty much. I mean, it had to do also with what Irene was saying before. I remember when he wrote the introduction to the Oas issue, I think we finished saying, speaking and remain silent at the same time. So it's the whole collection, the composition, everything he makes, the wittiness, makes a whole set of projects which are time and again need a lot of intellect to decipher, and has been said before, are an amazing accumulation of knowledge. But are that indeed by recombining things which are at hand? I agree with that.
And I guess what this is also about is what's the medium of theory when you talk about architecture? You know, we also accept that there is actually the accumulation of drawings, for example, is theory building. It's not.
Yes.
Can I
add maybe one more thing about the wit? I mean, to me, to say that. The cerebral side of Stirling was in the wit, is a very small part of it. It's a bit, I mean, the comparison has been made now quite a few times between Stirling and Hitchcock. If it'd be like saying that wit is where the thoughtful part of Hitchcock would be, I mean, it's obvious that with Hitchcock there is a lot more, about how to make a film and the importance of suspense and everything that we are familiar with. And I think likewise with Stirling. I mean, there is obviously a vast range of thought in his work, of which wit is only a very, very small part. It is perhaps the most visible part. It is, you know, it's the pink handrails and this sort of things. But at the end, I mean, at least in my mind, there is something enormously substantial, and I think substantial is not a bad adjective for it, in the way Stirling actually think buildings and arranges parts together in the building. And for me, if I were to say, but I shouldn't, I know, but if I were to say that there was a bottom line in the work, it would be there. It would be to do with the very particular and sometimes extraordinary skill with which parts are being put together, partly in the mind and partly in the drawing, in fact, in both at once. Yeah. And to me, this is much closer to what might actually be cerebral, intellectual, or theoretical in the work than, say, the wit.
Perhaps Claire, then?
I only have to sort of reinforce what's just been said, and I think we could avoid a lot of problems if instead of allowing the term theory to collapse into text, we would simply distinguish theoretical from textual representations, or textual representation from theory or theorizing. Certainly, I totally agree with what various people have been saying, that this is very theoretical work, but it's theorizing through the medium of architecture. I think one place it becomes slightly problematic is if we're going to say that Stirling is the architect who thinks through the medium of architecture. I don't have a difficulty with that, except insofar as we have to then establish what the medium of architecture in his lifetime was. So, for example, he did think textually as well, particularly in the early stages of his career, where he was articulating positions through text, maybe for the reason that it was more efficient at that time for him to do it that way. But so there's textual representations, which are actually, in a sense, part of this thinking through the medium of architecture. Mm-hmm. And similarly, I would also say that the design and construction of the books is equally a part of thinking through architecture. So I think one thing that bedevils architects today is the relationship between different kinds of formations, like textual formations versus drawn ones versus built ones. And that's, I think, what's complex about Stirling's work, is that the theorizing is taking place primarily through building, but at the same time what that means in the late 20th century is that it's also taking place through various forms of representation. I also kind of wanted to add to that my own sort of curiosity, specifically for Patrick, about what architects are going to do with this body of work in the future, and to strongly discourage the notion that there's a separation between those who decode Stirling through text, such as Emmanuel or I, and those who reformulate Stirling-esque things through their own future work. I think that we should try not to reestablish that division, but to diminish the separation, diminish the distance between talking and thinking and writing about Stirling's work and actually using it as a foundation for future architectural thinking, which is also textual and representational.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's exactly me. I don't know quite how. I went to Liverpool University, so people ask me to write about Stirling, so I write about Stirling. It's not the main thing I do in terms of writing, but I think I think you hit on something earlier. What people don't do very often is actually write about buildings properly. They theorize them as if they mean things before you've actually worked out what they're like to experience. So one thing running through my mind and whenever I come here is what is the role of colour playing in this building? Why is he doing it? For somebody who's a very mature architect, coming towards the end of his career, getting a commission that will almost certainly be listed at some point because of who you are as a client and what's in it. And dealing with questions of monumentality And I think two things are operating at once simultaneously. One is the critic in the architect, and the other is the individual visiting the building. And the ability to kind of operate and hold those things in tension is the key, I think, to understanding his creativity. So, for example, if you come in through the doors, you've entered into a picture that's been presented to you. There's a very large column that blocks your view of the stair, but you've seen the stair already, so you know the stair's there. The closer you get towards the stair, you start to realize that something's been set up in your minds before you've got into it. So you find yourself recognizing the experience that your imagination is projecting yourself into. On the left, there's a pink door handrail. Why is it pink and why is that one gray? It's linked to the reason why the lamp at the top is off-center of the staircase, which is linked to the reason why the window appears again at the top. It's because that's the main circulation route that he's set up, that is the public route he wants you to go to. And pink registers more strongly in your visual field than the thing there. However, unlike most architects who organize time and space in a linear fashion, I'm thinking particularly of the avant-garde, which everything's like a bloody theme park. You're trapped in a chair, you go through the ghost town, then you go through that, then you go through that, then you go through that. He's got section operating. And when you have section operating, you have time and memory operating at the same time, and you have choice. And then you have what he calls the programming of the hierarchies, or the hierarchizing of the program happening, where you have both that operating, you have that operating. That's another route through it, and he also knows that you're going to come back and experience it, which is what Irénée's delivered to us wonderfully today, is the fact that you see the thing that's supposed to guide you only properly when you've left it, i.e., you experience a work of art, you're in it, you leave, and if it leaves something in you, that's another pleasure of it. And that's deeply profound, I think, about what art can do, what architecture is like, and it's highly intellectual. However, I don't think he's simply manipulating you to achieve a series of effects, which is what a lot of theoretical architects try to do, unfortunately. You can see that very clearly in the architects that relate architecture to film, I think. Everything becomes a series of manipulations. These things, they require a lot of skill, a lot of imagination, and a lot of wit. And I think I used the word wit before you did. Wit is obviously an interesting ability to mean both, you know, intelligence, but also a sense of humor and a sense of distance from the situation. Now, similarly, I think the color is operating not just phenomenologically, it's also operating as a way to leaven the heavy loaf of the monument, so that your experience of something is not absolute, it's not just one thing. You're conscious of somebody's own ontological difficulty with making, at the end of the 20th century, something that will last for a very long time. And I think that's the thing that I think he starts to get. But arguably, when you know, the kind of precociousness of the Black Book, you know, he's already thinking of himself in terms of Le Corbusier and Moretti and people. He's placing himself into a firmament and a world which is also intellectual. You know, he's thinking about what he's doing in terms of what other great masters have done. And that's a practicing architect as well as the scholar. And I always say that Stirling, to me, clearly is an intellectual, and clearly he's involved in theory. It seems ridiculous to pretend he's not. What we get, though, is the idea that somehow Peter Eisenman is involved in theory. I don't think he necessarily is. His PhD is entirely functionalist and pragmatic. If you've read it, you know, it's very old school. Similarly, we get the idea that some architects, because their work is obscure, is somehow complex, which is not necessarily the case, is it? We think we have a real problem since Stirling's died about who we think is clever and who we think is theoretical and who we think is important or good architect. Mm-hmm. It's a big problem for architecture, I think. It's not just between people in the university. I teach in the university, I write, I build buildings, and do all these things. I'm not able to formulate my thought. I don't have the time to organize it in the same way. because I'm primarily engaged with a pencil in my hand. But when I'm with a pencil in my hand and writing and drawing, I don't see a distinction between those types of imagination or understanding. I wouldn't like to appear as somebody who's anti-intellectual at all, obviously. After that, you probably can't imagine that ever would be.
But if I could ask something very briefly.
Can you be a bit nearer the mic, I think?
Yeah. If I could ask something just very briefly, I think there is a risk to actually say that some architects just think through drawing and not at all in any other way. And I think clearly there is a lot more to Stirling in that respect. I mean, Stirling, after all, was a friend of most architecture critics who were working during his lifetime. And also it was a golden age of architectural criticism, I think, or a golden age of architectural criticism. And it is obvious that he knew very well what those people were about. And he and those thoughts were most probably in his mind, and in fact, very probably also those things were being discussed over whatever it is, coffee, dinner, and whatever else. And so I would take this, not knowing, obviously, you know, how it was at the time, but I would take this with a pinch of salt, that at the end, probably, Stirling was a man with a very articulate mind. That's my guess. But,
Brian Hatton needs a mic.
It seems to me maybe the cause of this particular itch that needs to be scratched is not the question of whether Stirling's intellectual or those questions arise because he didn't write enough, but because of a certain absence of what you might call an axiomatic way of proceeding. In contrast to the generation of Le Corbusier, or Frank Lloyd Wright for that matter, who designed speculative cities, or on the other hand, to, let's say, Leon Krier, who in a way has also drawn up his idea of what a city should be. As far as I know, Stirling didn't do any speculative projects. Everything was a response to a brief or a competition. And this is a remarkable characteristic compared to the previous generation. It's a sort of pragmatism. And so therefore, any aspect of manifesto in his work has to be found within the detail of each individual project. And it's the point at which the motivation for his design ceases to be defined by the brief or the program that you begin to find the lineaments, the elements of a manifesto or of an axiomatic position or anything that could be construed as theory. So in this case here, in the Turner wing, what always struck me was, at least from the outside, it's not the contextualism raises an issue of who is your neighbor. And so this building plays Chinese whispers around it. At the back, it's modernist. Then it's next to a kind of Queen Anne, pseudo Queen Anne building. Then it's next to a Neo-Palladian building. So the tectonics are subservient to the act of playing a contextual game in an uncontextual and inconsistent world where the context is restless, and so therefore, and it's inconsistent. Where is the principle of consistency in an architectural practice that situates itself in an inconsistent world? When it moves indoors, there's a different situation altogether, because of course there is no context other than the paintings. Now, at this point, perhaps you need to change the register and think about Stirling's relation to tectonics. He's very peculiarly inconsistent in a certain way, in that some of his work seems to be absolutely about tectonics, certainly the you know, it is his relation to functionalism and the Leicester building, let's say, and constructivism. It's supposed to be about tectonics, but in fact, as Eisenman pointed out in that article about it, and this takes me back to my question about Gestalt and the equivocations of figure and ground that keep arising in once you realize that Gestalt is not simply about strong images, it's about the equivocation between the image, or what is the image actually, whether it's the figure or the ground, but also between the tectonic and the atectonic. Now, Kenneth Frampton, in his book on tectonic culture, raises the observation made by Edward Seckler about the axiomatically atectonic in architecture. Seckler raises it in relation to Hoffman, the Viennese architect, that when you paint over a surface with a consistent color, you erase any question of what the structure is underneath. This is a point that Penelope raised it before in relation to Caro's sculpture. In the early 60s, in sculpture, there was a very interesting debate where people like Don Judd complained of Caro that by painting his sculptures, you couldn't see which bit was aluminium, which bit was lead, or whatever. Now, the very interesting analysis of the window that Irénée made me think, well, what exactly is the motive of this? And it is something I thought that the strangeness of it arises from its willful atectonicness. It cannot be explained on tectonic grounds. And color, the relation of color to tectonics is very, very strange, and that's one reason why architects are usually so uncomfortable with it. But of course, in relation to the contents of this building, namely paintings, and a particularly evanescent and atmospheric kind of painting, it makes total sense.
Okay, Brian, I think this is fantastically interesting. It also feels like feels like an invitation to actually stop here and now for the promised coffee break, tea and coffee, to actually sort of test some of this while you sort of consume your coffee. Also, this is not the last word, because we still have Anthony Wittler, sort of giving us all his thoughts. And before you all leave, also because Brian sort of made the connection, I would very much like to offer the floor to, I think it was Mark Swinnerton, who wanted to talk about something up north.
Just very briefly, because I'm sure everybody needs to have tea of that fascinating session, but just to remind you that in 2 weeks' time at Tate, Liverpool, there's a symposium on Stirling and the North, which will be looking at this topic that we touched on this afternoon, of the formation of Stirling within a northern culture, specifically within Liverpool. And we'll be having three talks. Robert Maxwell will be talking about Stirling the Northerner. Brian Hatton will be talking about Stirling as a photographer of Liverpool. And Elaine Harwood will be talking about the two big housing projects at Preston and Runcorn. So if anybody can join us for that, I think it's going to be a really interesting afternoon. Liverpool doesn't take very long to get to today. Since electrification of the railway, it only takes 2 hours and 8 minutes. So you can have a lovely time on what is practically the longest day of the year in Liverpool. So I hope some of you may be able to join us then. There's a little poster we've done for it with Edward Jones's portrait of Jim Stirling, which some of you probably won't have seen, because it's in the family collection. And there are copies of this on the desk at the front, where anybody wants one.
Thank you, Mark. We are running a bit behind schedule. May I suggest reconvening at about 10 to 5, please?